We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. When Barack Obama became president, he said that one of the first things he said was that he hoped to improve relations between America and the Arab Muslim world. The problem, however, says our guest for this hour of the show, John Esposito, who is professor of religion and international studies at Georgetown University, the problem is that the promise hasn't really been carried through by the United States and by this administration. In this hour of our show, we'll talk a little bit about the current state of relations between the United States and the Muslim world, particularly the Arab Muslim world. Perhaps also talk a little bit about the struggle for reform within Islam. And these are subjects that he has written about widely, talks about quite a lot. He is often interviewed in newspapers and magazines and in the media. He just told us this morning when he came into the studio that tomorrow he'll be on Capitol Hill talking about Libya, and we're very pleased to have him here. He's professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is the Thulin Lecture. It's sponsored by the Department of Religion, and his talk will be tonight, 8 o'clock, at the Spurlock Museum on the campus. Anyone who'd like to attend is welcome. And on this program, of course, we invite questions, comments. You can call us at 333-9455 or toll free 800-222-9455. You can email questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
I think that you have argued, a lot of other people have argued, that the assessment that Americans have about Muslims and about Islam is, to a great extent, built on ignorance. They just don't really know very much about Islam. And certainly they make assumptions about Muslims, what they think of the United States, what kind of government that they would like to have in their own countries if they don't live in the United States. I thought it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about some of the recent survey data that we have where the surveying organization, Gallup, for example, just really did a recent big survey, went out and actually asked people. They tried to ask average people in countries that were predominantly Muslim, asked them things like, well, what do you think about the United States? What kind of government would you like to have for your country? And so forth. We could talk for a long time about this, but a couple of high points that you would think would be really important for people to get.
Well, I think the first thing is to recognize that in a post 9/11 world, and in a world in which our media is very conflictual, you know, the average person and even the policymaker is really caught between a rock and a hard place. You can have two experts, two political commentators, both very well educated, taking diametrically opposed positions, talking about them. The reality of it is that with the Gallup World Poll, but also with Pew and others, and Gallup has the largest, most systematic study of the Muslim world, began with the World Poll looking at 35 countries, now about 44. You actually listen to the voices of that represent the voices of a billion Muslims. Now, what would people find surprising? First of all, when you ask Americans, for example, what do you admire about Islam, 54% say nothing or I don't know. When you ask people in the Muslim world, they're very quick to say that they admire our democracy, our freedoms, our rule of law, our work ethic, our accomplishments in education, technology, all the very things that we in America admire about ourselves. Mm-hmm. Okay. Secondly, when you talk about some of their fears, well, one of their fears is extremism and terrorism. And a lot of times we forget that. We think we're the only ones. Okay. Another interesting thing is that both Americans, non-Muslim Americans, and people in the Muslim world think that they care about relations with the other side, but the other side really doesn't care. But both of them feel the same way. Mm-hmm. They both believe that exchange and education are important, but there's a significant difference. For people in the Muslim world, foreign policy is important. That's not on our screen for many of us, because many of us as Americans think we're America. We're a good country. There can't be any significant problems with our foreign policy. The issue of democracy. Despite the fact that in many Muslim countries you don't have democracies, what our data showed is, in some ways, one shouldn't have been totally surprised at what we're seeing in the Arab world today. Majorities of Muslims want greater democratization, don't want corruption. They want greater accountability of their governments. And indeed, in many ways, what's happening in the Arab world goes against, supports the data, or vice versa, but goes against the stereotype that's existed for so long that, well, if they have authoritarian governments, it must be because they want them, or that there's something about their culture. And then a final point is women and women's rights. Majorities of Muslim men and women believe that Muslim women should have equal rights to citizenship, education, and employment. Now, they don't in many countries. They do in some. But in terms of what people want. Oh, and then the final point is, when we talk about what's the cause of extremism or terrorism, our data in Gallup supports the notion that at the end of the day, the primary drivers are political grievances or perceived political grievances, a sense of occupation, fear of being invaded, etc., not, if you will, theology. And that dovetails, for example, with Robert Pape's book at the University of Chicago on something like suicide bombing, which he looked at not only across the Muslim world, but across all religions across the world, and found that the majority of times the drivers were political grievances like occupation and not religion. Religion is secondary. It does get used to legitimate and mobilize.
Yeah. Well, this it's to connect that with what we have seen, this sort of wave of political activism that's really swept across North Africa and the Middle East, going back to December with the unseating now of two governments in Tunisia and in Egypt. And then also in Libya, we have what seems to be pretty much a full-out civil war, which is a little bit different. Then we have other places where there have been some efforts for people to demand political reform that have been met with force by their government. So every place is a little different. You have to treat it as something that's individual. But the overall point, I think, is really striking. And as I'm sure a lot of people who spend a lot of time studying this part of the world, if they were being honest, would say something like, we never would have imagined something like this could have happened.
Precisely. It's an excellent observation, because the reality of it is just about everybody, if they were honest, i.e. Muslim rulers themselves in these governments, Western governments that support them, experts, and people on the ground in the societies, including the reformers. Many of the people who initially responded or reacted in Tunisia and Egypt never expected the kind of almost quick outflow. But what happened was, Tunisia set an example for Egyptians and other people in the world that basically said, okay, we live in this authoritarian structure, and the fact is we know that if you step out, you could be shot, you could be imprisoned, or simply you and your family won't be able to get a job in the future, etc. But hey, what? A critical mass is willing to come out. And once people began to see a critical mass come out, then they saw a possibility, and then people were willing to go to the streets. But what it testifies to, and this is our real challenge, it's a challenge to all the players I just mentioned, we need a new framework. The old framework, the status quo that we had, just simply didn't work. And not only didn't it work, it led to repression of populations. It fed anti-Americanism, and to a certain extent anti-EU, anti-Europeanism, but particularly anti-Americanism. And it doesn't work. And the lesson we have to learn is that we've really got to develop a new framework as we move forward. If we fall back into an old framework and into the aspects of that old framework, it will be as disastrous as the way in which we still pursue a relatively old framework when we operate and look at Palestine and Israel.
Yeah. Well, just one, let me ask you one further question. I have a caller here. I promise I won't make this person wait forever. But I think that if it is the case, and I think this is the case, that the attitudes that you talked about initially, attitudes, say, Americans have about Islam and the Muslim world, if if people in government essentially have those same attitudes or were not much, terribly much more enlightened, and if they, when they looked at these events that you just mentioned, if they were being honest and said, we never would have thought such a thing, you know, that there would be an uprising in Egypt and Mubarak, who's been in power for decades, would be pushed aside, we never would have thought such a thing would happen. So if you look at the criticism that has been made that the United States wasn't making much of a response, how much of that is due to the fact that that government was just sort of caught by it and thought, well, now what do we do? I mean, there was no plan because they never really thought that something like that would ever happen, and so they didn't need to have a plan.
I think there are two factors. I think one, that government inherited a worldview. I mean, you know, remember that people like Gaddafi have been in 40 years, Mubarak for 30, so you inherit a system. You know, it's like during the Cold War, we had a way of looking at the Cold War, and then towards the end, a lot of people weren't ready to see that the Soviet Empire could crumble. But there's a second factor, which is the government bought into, whether Republican or Democrat, bought into the notion that, as they did during the Cold War, we may not like the nature of a lot of the people we deal with, but we can count on them on the issues that are important to us, issues of access to oil, security, the security of Israel, etc. And so we can pay that price without realizing what the implications of that were.
We have as our guest in the studio here John Esposito. He is professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. He is the founding director of the Prince Alawid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding in the Walsh School of Foreign Service. And he's written a lot about Islam and the Muslim world. He is here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk this evening on U.S. relations with the Muslim world, and questions on this show are welcome. We have a couple ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call, and we'll talk with some people who are listening. We'll start with a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have several comments about Professor Esposito, and I'd like to hear his responses. First is, Professor Esposito is often called Sheikh Qaradawi, and I might be mispronouncing his name, a reformist or a moderate or progressive. Well, these are all quotes from him. And yet this is the Sheikh who most recently on Al Jazeera called for a new Holocaust, quote, Allah willing, let us be the perpetrators to finish the job. Qaradawi also issued fatwas against calling for the killing of American troops in Iraq, for suicide bombing in Israel, and for death to apostates. So this is the advisor to the Muslim Brotherhood who Professor Esposito calls a reformist and a moderate. And this is the first problem I have with Professor Esposito, who is his university position and center is funded by the Wahhabi Saudis, who are fairly fundamentalist and who've tried to impose fundamentalist thinking on American Muslim mosques. In addition, Professor Esposito often has tended to try to justify or whitewash criticism of Muslim terrorists, most recently with Colonel Hassan, who the Fort Hood shooter, who was yelling Allah Akbar while he was killing American soldiers.
Is there a question?
We really need to kind of get things moving along here so we can get some response.
The question is whether Professor Esposito is really, what should I say, a justifier of Islamic extremism, or if he's simply someone who uses his position to try to whitewash Islamic terrorism and not have the United States face the real threats that they come from Islamic fundamentalists and extremists.
All right, there's something we can deal with. And go ahead.
Yeah, in the old days, I would answer it in one way, but I'll answer it now in a different way. First of all, there's a certain stupidity to saying that that I or anybody else is whitewashing Islamic terrorism, because if that were the case, we would be having a lot more difficulties with security people in our country. But you're more interested in sort of, attacking me, so that's kind of interesting. Colonel Hassan You'd have to be pretty absurd and not do your reading to realize that the all you did is make an accusation with no proof. The question of a Wahhabi-funded center. The center I created was in 1993. It wasn't until 5 years ago that we received a $20 million endowment from Prince Al-Wali bin Talal. If you actually look at his history, he works with everybody from Rupert Murdoch to Bill Gates in business. He is a very liberal Saudi. He's far from Wahhabi. If you're able to read, you might want to look a week or two ago and read an op-ed in the New York Times in which he not only supported the democracy move, but in the Arab world, but in fact, in praising the King of Saudi Arabia, said with regard to Saudi Arabia that obviously this would just be the first step in a process of reform. I would take a look at the fact that after 9/11, because he wanted Arabs to understand the Muslim world better, he created or funded centers at the American University of Cairo and the American University of Beirut in order to do that, and then has done the opposite at Harvard and Georgetown and in Europe to the other way in order to get populations to know each other better. So I'd really do a little bit more reading, and I might pick up my book, The Future of Islam, and see what I say about Yusuf Qardawi there, because I really don't have time to go on. But I really think that reading beyond the quotes that I can almost tell you the sources for this, all you're doing is memorizing a template, really doesn't address anything.
Well, to what extent is there a threat to the United States from militant Islamists? And how great is the threat, and where does it come from?
Well, I think that there obviously is a threat. We have 9/11, and we thwart threats. That is, there's a threat of from outside, and there can be also a threat, obviously, from inside. I mean, that exists. No one denies that. The question really has to do with the dimension of the threat, and on that, our government can't really agree on that, nor do most experts. But no one denies that there is a threat. The question is the magnitude of the threat, and also where is that threat coming from, and what are the causes of that threat, and how does one address that threat? For example, if you're talking about trying to counter homegrown terrorism, okay, the question is you have to be concerned about countering homegrown terrorism. And indeed, if you look at the latest, for example, Peter King hearings, Mr. King, who looked into it, the amazing thing was he had hearings on it, and I'm sure your caller in would have approved of King's hearings, and he never felt it necessary to have any of the leaders of Homeland Security or the FBI on. Whereas when Senator Durbin had his hearings, he had an assistant in the Justice Department who talked about the working relationship with the majority of the Muslim community. So I think that we just have to begin to start formulating our policies on the basis of information. But there's no doubt about the fact that there are threats globally. The threats exist and are palpable, particularly in Muslim societies. We continue to see that taking place from extremism, but they certainly are palpable in Europe and America.
Yeah. We're here at the point where we're already almost midpoint. We have a caller I want to get to in just a moment. And we do also need to take a very quick break here to encourage people to support the station. We'll make this real quick because I want to get back to the caller and get back to the issue. This, I hope, is an example of the kind of shows that we've been doing now, well, over the last 30 years, talking about important issues where people are going to disagree. But I also hope that we create an atmosphere where people can do that in a reasonable sort of way. That is one of the features of the show. People have said that they appreciate it. Again, this is just an opportunity. We're trying to encourage people to support the station, and this show, but not just this show, everything else we do. Dave Teal's here in the studio with me. He's the program director of WILL-TV.
Yeah, and I mean, this really points to one of the important things about this show, that people are invited to call in with their perspective. Sometimes you're going to hear opinions you don't agree with, and that's okay. You know, it's okay that people have different opinions. We can, as people like to say, you can disagree without being disagreeable. We welcome different opinions. We also, of course, this morning welcome your pledges of financial support. And that the phone number to call is 217-244-9455. And, of course, you can pledge online at willpledge.org. And I don't want to take any more of your time, Dave.
Well, let me introduce again the guest for anybody who might have just joined us. John Esposito is professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. He is currently the vice president and president-elect of the American Academy of Religion. He has authored a number of books having to do with Islam, including Islamophobia and the Challenge of Pluralism in the 21st Century, The Future of Islam, and a number of others. And go to the library, go to the bookstore, look for his books. He's here visiting the campus for the Thulin Lecture. This is sponsored by the Department of Religion, University of Illinois, here in Urbana-Champaign. He'll be talking tonight at 8 in the Spurlock Museum. And if you'd like to hear him, you should feel welcome. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can email us as well, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Piatone, line 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. And before I get into my question, I love this show. I have supported in the past, and I continue to. And thanks, Dave, and all the crew there for having it there. I love it. You guys are great.
Well, thanks.
I guess one of my questions would be, you know, with all the media hype out there, I personally, in my opinion, tend to not believe a lot of what the media says because I think they're just trying to sell a product out there. And I think from what I'm getting from you is that there might not be as much extremism as you think there is. Having grown up in California for years, I kind of tend to go to, I always tell people, I think East L.A. and Watts and South Central, as far as terrorism, is far worse than anything we can get from outside of our borders. In fact, I personally think that our gangbangers and whatnot in the country are probably far worse as far as terrorists, and I consider them terrorists, homegrown terrorists, than you can get outside of it. Now, do I believe the Muslims are terrorists or having an organization that sets up? No, I don't, because I know a lot of my friends are Muslims, and not one of them has ever said anything wrong one way or the other. And I'm just wondering, are you getting the same observation? Do you think a lot of this media is just kind of hype trying to sell something, or is there really a problem out there? I'll get off and thanks again, guys.
All right.
There are two dimensions to the problem. One is the reality, and the reality of our society is we have a wide open, market-driven society, and it's business. Business drives it, and media has become big business, which is fine. I mean, that's what we do. But that means you have a bottom line. It means that you compete for audiences. It means that you need to attract a big audience, and anybody would be disingenuous who didn't say that what attracts an audience is conflict and conflict discourse. So you look at the kinds of items that are going to pull in an audience. It's going to be reporting on conflict. Or if you look at the way in which a lot of our discussions more and more are this kind of debating sort of format that often can get into a kind of shouting match. But the other part of it is the fact that we really don't pay attention to where we have hard data. For example, major polling by the Pew organization, by the Gallup organization, has demonstrated that the following, and I hope listeners will listen very carefully to this. The majority of American Muslims are educationally, economically, and politically integrated and professionally integrated. Muslims are second to American Jews in terms of levels of education. The majority of Muslims are integrated in terms of a sense of being American citizens. So Muslims are like most other ethnic groups or most ethnic groups and religious groups that come here. It takes a while to integrate, but they've become integrated. It's a much different situation, for example, than Europe, where most of the Muslims that went there were rural and blue collar. Most Muslims who came here. We have also African-American Muslims, and I'm talking about the two-thirds of so-called immigrant Muslims, are people who came with skills or came and studied and got skills. And they want the same thing that every other American wants. Now, are there, have we had some terrorists from within that community? Yes, as we have in the past in our history from other communities. But we need to have a broader context in within which we place this discussion. And often people are simply unaware of what the hard facts are. Read a book called Less Safe, Less Free, and that will introduce you to the policies that we've had since post 9/11. It'll introduce you to policies of Homeland Security and FBI, the numbers of Arabs and Muslims who were brought in, the percentages that were found guilty of anything, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to deal with reality and not with, you know, with the fear mongering that sometimes is out there.
Returning to the U.S. response to what has been happening in North Africa and the Middle East in the last few months, I'm sure that you actually have been in the position of being asked, how do we get a handle on this? How do we understand this? And what should the response of the United States be? If the United States wants to continue to have good relations with governments in the region, and we do have interests, what should the United States, what can the United States do to try to support democratic reforms in places like Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and any place else?
Well, I think that, you know, I've said for years and others have said, the answer is very simple but very difficult to implement in terms of policy. We need to walk the way we talk. If we're going to say that we believe in democratization and human rights, then we need to be seen as standing up for those in all parts of the world. During previous president, George W. Bush, his senior State Department official, before we went into Iraq, basically acknowledged that under all administrations, previous administrations, recent previous, Democrat or Republican, we had practiced democratic exceptionalism in the Middle East. So we promoted it every place but the Middle East because we had a sense that stability and security was based on supporting the regimes and that elections, we couldn't control how they would turn out. Mm-hmm. That democratic exceptionalism is what has fed anti-Americanism. Here, by anti-Americanism here, I mean in the Muslim world and many other parts of the world. Not people that hate us or America. They're people who want to study here, want to live here, want to visit. But anti-America, they have a problem with our foreign policy. It also, of course, becomes a tool for extremists and terrorists. So our challenge now, though, which is difficult, is how do we both respond to the facts on the ground, what's unfolding, let alone how do we construct a, as it were, a new foreign policy that is far more open and pluralistic in its approach, is far more willing to accept what the notion of self-determination and realizing that that's a crapshoot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's true in our own country. Because we have an open system, many of us, those that are listening to myself, can have a candidate elected that we just think is a horror. You know, but we don't attempt to overthrow the government. And if we get our candidate in, we don't want the military to intervene to keep our candidate in forever. And I think but that's a very difficult challenge because it means that you are changing. And for an administration, it can look like a lose-lose situation if anything goes wrong, if anything goes wrong on its watch.
Yeah, I mentioned at the beginning that made this reference to President Obama and the fact that one of the very first things that he did when he was president, one of the very first things that he talked about in terms of priorities, he said he wanted to improve relations between the United States and the Muslim world. And I think that you've been rather critical of the president and the administration for follow through on that. How have we done so far?
I was a great supporter of President Obama as a candidate and being elected. I think that he's, our best hope for the foreseeable future. And so I, in every way, want to see him succeed. What I've said is not only my opinion, but it's been reflected in polling. Obama had fantastic responses to his Cairo speech. And before that, his speech in Turkey. I was in Turkey when he gave his speech in Ankara. And it went a long way in the Middle East and North Africa to as it were, buttressing and building up a much more positive attitude towards the American administration. But the problem is that over time, his deliverables haven't really been there, whether it's Guantanamo, whether it's Palestine and Israel and the way that has not succeeded. In a variety of ways, his administration has not addressed the significant abuses that took place with regard to Muslim civil liberties during the previous administration, has not reexamined them. And what you see then is that in the Middle East and North Africa, the numbers start really dramatically going down. The window starts to close. Now, there's an interesting thing here. For some people, the window's closing because some people are just becoming cynical or maybe are negative on Obama. For others, they're not negative on Obama. For others, it's that they may believe that Obama simply has reflected the realities of American politics, that you have a Congress that tilts strongly one way, for example, on Palestine and Israel. You have a strong domestic lobby on that issue. As Park 51 and post-Park 51 showed, you have a significant kind of anti-Muslim or Islamophobic sentiment that exists. As the congressional election showed, when we had mainstream politicians engaging in effect, Islamophobic rhetoric, clearly demonstrating that they're not appealing to simply redneck voters. They believe there's a significant base there. You know, you see it even reflected lately with Mr. Trump, who brings up the charges or the questions about the president and his citizenship, etc. So there are many in the region who may think that Obama is still, you know, a terrific person, but are totally disappointed in his inability to deliver. And at its worst, what it winds up saying to people is it doesn't matter who's president. That you've got this structural problem, and until it's addressed, you know, things are not going to get better. And that's why America's involvement and leadership in a multilateral approach to what's going on in the Arab world now is so very important. We cannot afford to stand back completely as others move forward.
Well, you talk about people's attitudes and where attitudes come from. I'm sure that President Obama has stood up and in no uncertain terms has decried attacks on Muslims and have said, no, that this is really not about religion. President Bush said after 9/11, he said, we are not at war with Islam. That is not what this is all about. The two of them, you know, the current and the previous president, couldn't have been much more clear about that. But it seems that just having the president stand up and say that is not enough.
That's right. And you get into what are the deliverables. That is, we've got the Iraq situation, which hopefully will resolve. But, you know, you had not just an invasion to bring democracy, but an invasion that led to an occupation. And our policy did change over time. But it's very clear in the early days, a few analysts, would deny it. We had the candidate that we expected to see in power in Iraq. We had the ability to configure the kind of electoral system they would have. At one point, Ambassador Bremer said when there was a debate on the Constitution and its law, said, it's not law until I say it's law. Now, that doesn't communicate what we say. The situation in Afghanistan, we've actually upped the number of troops. The numbers of civilians being killed is significant. We seem to be in an intractable situation in Afghanistan. And Palestine and Israel, both presidents, I think it was laudable, both presidents held up as an important feature in their administration that they were going to address and resolve that issue. You don't do it unless you're willing to take the risks, and neither of them were. And the risk is that you can lose votes in an election. The risk is, in Obama's case, that he could be a one-term president, you know, if things really went wrong. And so in an interesting kind of way, you don't create rising expectations, because that becomes the yardstick by which people will judge you. And remember, the real way you could see it was Obama was very strong on the settlement issue and calling them illegal settlements and going head-to-head, toe-to-toe with Mr. Netanyahu. Then he backed off. And then in the end, recently in a UN vote, the United States cast a veto. in which you had a 180-degree reversal. Mm-hmm. This affects credibility, even though you and I can explain maybe the political, domestic political reasons behind that, or, you know, where the president was coming from. You know, for people who are under the gun, as it were, and this is also true with regard to what's going on in the Arab world in terms of our responses, let's say, with regard to to Mubarak, Tunisia. It's going to be true with regard to our responses in Libya and Bahrain. You know, people are going to be looking and saying, great speeches have to have deliverables. Mm.
We have about 7-8 minutes left. We have, as our guest here in this studio, John Esposito. He's professor of religion and international affairs and also of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. He'll be giving a talk on the campus tonight. We have a caller here. We'll certainly get them in. And if somebody else wants to call real quick, we can try and do another 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Effingham, line number 4. Hello?
Thank you, David. Could your guest identify and talk about the relationship between what we now call capitalism? He opened that door by saying, talking about business, pseudo-democracy, and colonialism. Thank you.
I hope I'm going to be answering your question. I'm not sure that I fully understood it. I think that one of the things that we've had a problem with in terms of our image is this sense of not just colonialism as European colonialism, and I'm sure the caller recognizes this, and this is what he's talking about, but the sense of Western. Contemporary Western colonialism, i.e. Bush and Blair, for example, were seen as raising a notion of Western imperialism, you know, that we are going to bring democracy to this part of the world. And then also, for example, in the elections that occurred with regard to Hamas, whether we like Hamas or not, the fact is Hamas's elections by all observers was a recognition that these were free and fair elections. And yet we then adopted policies which attempted to actually, counter the results of those elections. But I think that what we've wound up having is a situation where we've had both pseudo-democracy in recent years on the part of some of the regimes, i.e. in the last 10 years, they'd hold elections. But the problem was in some countries, the government controlled the political parties, whether or not you could be a political party or not. The government controlled the media, and so the opposition couldn't be in the media. The government controlled the ability to politically organize. The government is the chief employer, and so if you really got involved in politics, whether you were a bureaucrat, a military person, or a teacher, you might lose your job. The question now is whether we'll wind up with pseudo-democracies in terms of the kinds of countries that emerge. But I also think that part of our policy was also driven not only by the politics, but also by a certain kind of capitalism, which had to do with, a kind of open capitalism that played to the advantages of elites in many of these countries. And so one of the things in Egypt, for example, when we move towards what ought to be more technological, educational, and economic aid rather than military, is that it's not simply we ought to just be giving money away. We ought to be demanding that many of the really wealthy elites in Egypt invest more money in their country. When in fact, what we've had are great relationships between these Egyptians and others and Western capitalists, but often without any impact on their own societies.
We're coming down. We have a couple of minutes left, unfortunately. Maybe one other question. If you, for example, you look at a place like Egypt, which is now we really don't quite know what's going to happen. The old government is gone, although elements of that old government are still in place. And some people would argue essentially what we had here really was a military coup. And so we don't know what direction the country is going to take. If you look at those people that are maybe now in a position to chart a different direction for the country, if suddenly you find yourself in a position to do something that you actually never really thought you'd be able to do, it's kind of hard to prepare for something if it never really seemed like it was that day was ever going to arrive. So I mean, how do they move forward?
Well, precisely. And in fact, there are programs and projects that are dealing with that. People in the region, NGO people, people who are, want to be strong in civil society, et cetera, are themselves, and many have backgrounds. I mean, you have sophisticated people, but many are looking outside for outside examples on how do you move forward. Mm-hmm. And there are many on our side. We're going to try to run a major project where we'll bring in people from South Africa, Chile, and other countries that have gone through similar processes, and have them meet with people from Egypt, Tunisia, and elsewhere. But that is a challenge. And I did want to mention, if your first caller in emails me, I will be happy to send him some of my writing so that he can see the full context, and then he can make his judgment based on that in terms of the positions that I take.
Mm. One other thing that this could be an entire program, but maybe you can talk a little bit about what sort of conversation is going on today within the Islamic world, and of course that's huge, about engaging in politics, about what kind of government is good government, about what sort of opportunities people ought to have, and about how you achieve political change particularly in a nonviolent manner.
There are all kinds of diverse conversations. For example, as we saw in the Arab world, majorities want greater democracy. But as we also saw in the Arab world, the majorities are not being led by those that are Islamic political activists. They may be part of the movement, but in fact, the leadership, that hasn't been the case. And many in the leadership have even, will say, and you'll see them in interviews, say, look, I may be a practicing Muslim, but I'm talking about issues that have to do with state, with rule of law, would have to do with economic development, and not talking about establishing, a formal religious a government. I think that there are clearly, most people in the Muslim world have seen the so-called political Islamic governments that have been set up in places like Iran and Sudan and the Taliban, et cetera, and see them for all the failures and follies that exist. And there's a particular concern not only about authoritarianism in terms of secular, but also religious authoritarianism, and very much a continuing concern about extremists and what can happen, for example, if you have elections. But I think the important thing is that if societies put in strong, pluralistic societies with multi-parties in a multi-party system, then votes get cast in a variety of ways. If you only have one party running in opposition, then people will be voting for that party, not only those who are supporters, but people who want to vote against the government. And then that skews the outcome of the elections and the kind of society you have.
Yeah, it's striking that just to take Egypt for an example, because of the concern that so many people have about Islamists coming into power, that in this particular case, the main opposition group, the Muslim Brotherhood, which was, of course, officially banned, but it was still the main opposition group, seemed to take almost no part at all in what happened and have really been hanging back. And actually, I think also they're in the process of trying to figure out, where to from here. And some very interesting conversations seem to be going on that pit the younger ones against the older ones. So in what we've been seeing now, have Islamist political organizations had important parts to play?
They have played. The Muslim Brotherhood refused the organization early on, as many did, the head of the Coptic Church, senior Muslim officials, to support this kind of movement. But individuals were, involved, but not leading at all. And in fact, they've gone out of their way to say that in elections they intend to run candidates, but they would not accept positions in cabinet. They would run nobody for president. And the important thing when you look at the Muslim Brotherhood is to realize that for almost 40 years, they've operated within the system nonviolently up against a government. And again, if you read human rights reports and others, a government that consistently arrested, imprisoned them during elections, tortured members of their group. But what this shows is that, and this is what is important for the future, Tunisians and Egyptians will have to continue what they said before, that this is all about a united Egypt. And the slogans were not about implementing Islam. The slogans have been a resurrection of pride, an emphasis on dignity of the unity of Egyptians and Tunisians despite their differences. And that's what they have to stick to.
Hmm. We are going to have to stop because we're here at the end of our time. For people who are around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, John Esposito, he'll be giving a talk. This is the Thulin Lecture, sponsored by the Department of Religion at University of Illinois, tonight, 8 o'clock at the Spurlock Museum, and all are welcome. John Esposito is professor of religion and international affairs and of Islamic studies at Georgetown University. And if you are interested in reading some of his books, you can go out to the bookstore, to the library. He has a number of books about Islam and that deal with this subject we've been talking about here, particularly about relations between the Muslim world and the West. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. To be here.